Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone.
Who cares about his, you know, commercial activities?
We're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 311.
I'll bring you the details.
Senator Roblin is here, and we'll take a briefing first from Kyle.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, Senate Bill 311, we do have a dash one amendment in there as well. That's up there in all lists, and I have in the SMS as well a description of both. What Senate Bill 311 does, and it makes a number, it's creating a new property tax exemption. And there's quite a bit going on there, so I'll try to hit the high points in the staff measure summary. But it might sound a little bit familiar as well to the committee, because some of the language is similar to the Brownfields legislation went through House Bill 4084 last session. But it authorizes a city or a county to adopt an ordinance or resolution that provides an exemption or a partial exemption from ad valorem property taxation to eligible property that in the introduced version, it's to property that has been seismically retrofitted. The dash one will make that going forward. So it won't be property that's been seismically retrofitted in the past, but property going forward, and specifically to property or improvements to property that's built on or after January 1st, 1993, or before 1993, excuse me. So it'll be some of the older property that's where it'll be limited to. And the partial exemption or the exemption, the property tax exemption, is up to 15 years, and it's going to be in the amount, generally in the amount of the eligible costs related to the seismic retrofit. And it would be up to the city or the county to specify the percentage of the exemption to be applied to the property, with the limit being those costs of the retrofit related to the seismic retrofit. The eligible property is specified in the measure. One thing I would point out is it doesn't apply to property that's centrally assessed or state appraised industrial property. There are specifications related to the eligible costs, what those can be. There's also broad authority given to the local government to put in place restrictions that are, as long as they don't conflict with what's in the statute, they can go above and beyond the restrictions and the qualifications that are in place in the measure. There is a clawback provision, and it does require a combined rate of taxation of up to 75% of the local districts to give more or less the okay for the exemption to be put in place. So there's an authority requirement there. And there is a sunset for the measure January 2nd, 2028. There's plenty more going on here, but I'll just try to stick there with that one.
There's a lot going on here. Senator Roblin and Representative Boone.
I'll do the 100,000 foot level. Good morning, committee chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I actually introduced a similar bill on the House side, but we're going to be going with the Senate bill. This bill, again, is a tool for the cities and counties to use. It's something that comes out of way back the resilience plan. And these are all for seismic retrofits, assisting people in this case, cities and counties. Doesn't take anything out of the state revenues. So, and I'm going to let Senator Roblin tell you more because it's his bill, too.
So for the record, Senator Arne Roblin, Senate District 5, most of the central part of the coast, all the way from the south to the north. Debbie and I have been engaged on the tsunami kinds of conversations and the resiliency task force, and have been spending a lot of time looking at what we can do along the coast to try to make us a little more resilient. We know, depending where the epicenter is, the devastation is going to be pretty consistently bad. We also know the valley is going to get hit pretty hard. So we're hoping that, you know, the helicopters will come and take our people over to Redmond and those other places where we're trying to fix Highway 97 to make it a little bit more armored so we have a transportation corridor. But in that conversation, we have seen how much money is needed to retrofit all the buildings, and it's kind of staggeringly unbelievable. So we don't expect that we're going to get to fix anything and everything, and we don't expect the state can afford to pay everything. And so when different ideas emerge, like this one, it's pretty easy for a lot of us to recognize this is a could be a really good plan to make sure that some of our buildings, and the 1992, after that, the building codes really started to acknowledge that we are going to have a large earthquake, and things were put into place so that new buildings after that were in much better shape. So what this bill is trying to do is say cities and counties should have an opportunity to put some money in the game to decide which buildings do we really need to have. You know, we're looking at building a new building at the University of Oregon's Newport Center, and part of the conversation is about really building it to the highest standards you can possibly build so that after one of these earthquakes, there will be some place that people can gather when all the houses are gone and other stuff so that you can get out of the rain and out of the misery in a building we hope can survive that. And engineers are telling us they can do some of those things. The things we've seen around the world have shown that certain buildings have been able to be habitable again after these earthquakes. So here we're trying to say we would love to put in place a way for counties and cities and those special districts that all use property tax to encourage people to do a plan. And we got fairly specific in this bill about you've got to have a plan ahead of time. You've got to be able to watch the plan. If you don't do the plan, we're going to take the money back. All of the kinds of things that we really, I think, hope make it a very accountable plan in the long run. But an opportunity for counties and cities to have a real conversation about what do they want to do and how are they going to deal with a big earthquake in their area. So I encourage you to look seriously at this bill and to pass it. We have a number of people that are going to come up after us to talk about how we can implement it. We were pleased to join with Portland. This is going to be a state disaster. It's not going to be about the coast, even though we know it'll be really hard on the coast. It's going to be really hard in the valley, too. And Portland in particular is another one of those places that, like a lot of these coastal towns, was built on a lot of fill and other kinds of things. And so getting down to bedrock, doing the kinds of things to make a building safe, it's going to be really important that there are buildings standing after the earthquake. So that's kind of the genesis of this. We've been thinking about this for the whole time we've been in the legislature, Debbie probably more than I, and so I give her a lot of credit for the resiliency stuff and the kinds of things. And again, it's not about the earthquake itself as much as it is about the after effect, which is going to be a lot harder on people. So any questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
Senator Wilkowitz?
I would just, an observation that Lincoln County Schools has been doing, is probably the leader along the Oregon coast in trying to figure out what to do 30 seconds afterward. Making progress in this committee. We'll see some bills coming from my Veterans Committee on that. And preparation, contrary to popular belief, needs to be in the 30-day plus window, because there is not enough helicopter fuel in Redmond to be able to even get over the mountain to this side and back, let alone farther out. So any efforts that we do, we need to consider that, and despite what everybody's saying, is if the school falls down around them, we don't want that either. So good luck, Mr. Chair.
And I will say Lincoln County has done a number of unique things, which I really appreciate. The schools have a really great person who has worked with the counties and others. So the county government puts out grants for individual organizations if they want to put together a emergency container, and they put the container out, and then it gets filled with materials, so it's available for people after the event. There's a hill just outside of the Oregon State University campus in Newport that is the place where everybody is going to go to. They've put trails up to the top. There's containers up there with the materials in it. NOAA will also be using that same place, so they've all worked together. And many of the communities in Lincoln County have begun developing their own containers and doing that kind of stuff. They've been having conversations about what they can do. It's the only airport for the Coast Guard that's above the tsunami zone. So we anticipate, depending on how the movement of the earth, that it will be a place where you can get in and out. We've been looking up and down the coast for those kinds of places. Just south of Bandon, there's another big airstrip that was built there in the Second World War that we hope or we're going to get fixed up a little bit. It's been part of the conversation that's been going on. So there are a lot of conversations going on the coast. This is one that just extends a little bit further, and I appreciate what they are doing in the Veterans Committee, too, because most people don't realize that there's just not large quantities of fuel out there that are in containers that are safe enough to survive the event. So, thanks.
All right. Thanks to both of you. We're going to keep working on this. We'll let you get back to your respective committees.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, let's call up the City of Portland. And I've got Dan, Carmen, and Hammett.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dan Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland, here today with Carmen Merlo and Amit Kumar in support of Senate Bill 310. Thank you for taking the opportunity to hear this bill. And would also like to thank the leadership of Senator Roblin, Representative Boone, and Representative McEwen on this issue. As staff mentioned, Senate Bill 311 is modeled on the authorization approved in the 2016 legislative session for local brownfield cleanup programs. The Dash 1 amendment that you have on OLIS reflects conversations that we have had with the assessors, the State Department of Revenue, as well as building owners to address technical issues, clarify the eligible costs in the bill, reference nationally recognized seismic retrofit standards, as well as ensure that other incentives for seismic retrofitting are factored into any exemption that are granted to a property owner. There may be a couple minor clarifications that we seek to add moving forward as well. We will be happy to address any questions that you might have at the end, but wanted to provide some background on this issue and then walk through a few of the key provisions of the bill.
Morning, Chair Hath, members of the committee. Carmen Merlo, the director of the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. We know that there's scientific consensus and geologic evidence that shows that Oregon is at risk for a very large magnitude Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Recent research by Chris Goldfinger at Oregon State University suggests that there's a 22% chance of a magnitude 9 earthquake in the next 50 years. And for the southern portion, an even greater risk, a 37% chance in the next 50 years. But if that wasn't enough, Oregon also has many local crustal faults. In fact, in Portland, the Portland Hills Fault, which is directly underneath the city of Portland, would create as much damage, if not more, than the Cascadia subduction zone itself. Because we weren't aware of our seismic risk until just recently, current building codes, which didn't pass until 1993, just simply didn't address the seismic risk that we currently face. And in addition to the immediate life safety risk posed by many of these buildings, there's really a long-term risk to the city's and county's economic recovery. And that's because when these buildings are damaged, if not collapsed, they end up displacing many businesses and residents, and that slows down the economic recovery and social recovery of the city and county. Unreinforced masonry is just one kind of these very vulnerable buildings. We also have at the very top soft story buildings, and then at the lower left, something called non-ductile concrete. It's concrete with very little steel reinforcement. These are all examples of earthquake damage on top in California, at the bottom in Christchurch, and then the one you see with the cars from the Nisqually earthquake in Seattle. I wanted to show you a fairly dramatic before and after photo. This is the city of Christchurch, and you're looking at the downtown central core. The photo on the left is obviously before the earthquake, and then to your right is after. The city of Christchurch lost 70% of the buildings in the downtown central business district, not because these buildings collapsed, but because very many of them sustained such heavy damage they had to be demolished anyway. We know that retrofits do work. These are a couple of examples of churches and historical societies that have undergone seismic retrofits. The challenge is they're very expensive, and they don't allow the property owner to pass these costs on to the renters in many cases. For the last 2 years in Portland, we've been convening a group of property owners, geologists, engineers to come up with strategies to mitigate the risk posed by these buildings. And hands down, a tax exemption was probably the most reasonable option that we came up with.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Amit Kumar. I'm a senior structural engineer with the City of Portland. I wanted to talk a little bit about the performance standards in Senate Bill 311. So under the property is eligible for a tax exemption under Senate Bill 311 would be required to meet to be seismically upgraded to meet certain standards. This is referenced on page 2 of the Dashman amendments. The seismic upgrade would need to meet the requirements contained in a national standard published by the American Society of Civil Engineers, or AAC for short, specifically AAC 4113. A registered engineer or architect would have to come up with a plan and certify that the plans meet the seismic upgrades in the AAC 4113. This AAC 4113, the buildings are required to be seismically upgraded to meet a performance standard known as a basic performance objective. What that means is this standard provides different levels of upgrade depending on what the building use is and the importance of the building. But in general, most of these buildings would have to be upgraded to what we call as a life safety standard. What that means is that in a design level earthquake, these buildings would suffer some damage. They could be repaired, but it allows for safe passage for occupants of the building to exit the building. So this is a national standard that is used throughout the country for evaluation of existing buildings and for providing seismic upgrades of these buildings. So the bill also contains some flexibility to allow local cities and counties to come up with an alternate standard depending on the local conditions there. As far as eligible costs are concerned, they are referenced on page 1 of the -1 amendment. All the costs that would be eligible would be directly related to structural seismic retrofitting, including but not limited to the costs necessary for demolition and restoration of similar architectural finishes, electrical systems, plumbing, and mechanical systems, including architectural and engineering fees, fees for testing, insurance, and project management. Costs do not include anything that would be required for refurbishing or remodeling. So, for example, if the owner of the building decides when they're doing a seismic upgrade, they want to upgrade their flooring from tiles to marble, that kind of costs are not included, only costs that are related to seismic upgrades. Costs for abatement of hazardous materials are also excluded. Costs for relocation and loss of rent during seismic retrofitting, those are excluded from the eligible costs.
Okay, we wanted to provide you with just a couple of real-world examples. This is the Ace Hotel in downtown Portland, constructed in 1912. It's a four-story building. You can see that their annual property taxes were about $99,000, so the 15-year value of the exemption would be $1.1 million. This is a really nice amount. It could provide up to $30 a square foot for the retrofit costs. The local jurisdiction could either cap this benefit or provide the full amount. As another example, this is a multifamily unit, Lucretia Court, constructed in 1910. It's a five-story building, and the 15-year value of that exemption would be $420,000. I want to point out that in no case did we identify a building where the total amount of the tax exemption would equal the cost of the retrofit.
Lastly, we would just like to call out some of the provisions in the bill and the -1 amendment regarding how this program would be implemented and the associated accountability provisions. So as Amit mentioned, retrofits would need to be consistent with nationally accepted standards or locally specified standards. There are also requirements in the existing bill for a building owner to demonstrate reasonable progress, or it would be subject to clawback provisions. The Dash 1 amendment also clarifies that the project must be completed consistent with the plan that was approved, or it would be subject to clawback provisions. And at the front end, in order for a city or county to implement a program, local jurisdictions representing 75% of the property tax base would need to agree to the program. That is a very high bar. It's consistent with the authorization that was approved for local brownfield cleanup programs. The Dash 1 amendment also makes explicit that a program may establish a overall cap on the amount of exemptions that are granted to provide additional predictability or certainty about the revenue impacts of a program. Additionally, local programs can be tailored to prioritize the highest risk buildings, such as unreinforced masonry or unreinforced concrete buildings. And local jurisdictions may impose additional restrictions beyond those that are specified in the bill. So thank you for your time. We're happy to address any questions.
Questions of the panel from Portland. Senator Bercher.
Thank you. So this is optional, and it's case-by-case basis also, correct?
Chair Haas, Senator Bertschiger, this authorization is optional for cities or counties to choose to implement a program if they have sufficient agreement from other local taxing jurisdictions in the area. And then once a program is implemented, property owners would need to submit applications to participate in the program, and those applications would need to be reviewed and approved by either the city or county that's chosen to implement a program. And the city or county that implements the program, once they've approved an application, would forward that information to the county assessor's office, who would record it on the tax rolls.
Only concern is that county or city has the ability to pick winners and losers. And that's the only concern I have. I don't.
Well, by making this permissible, that is their problem, as it were. And really, the elusive question that we always deal with in tax breaks is, at what point are you changing behavior to create an incentive to do something that might be in the public's interest versus giving someone a tax break for something a building owner, in this case, might have done anyway. So, but by making it permissible, that's now your issue. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Haas. I just wanted to understand, so in the bill, is there any criteria for the selection? I mean, is it first come, first serve? I mean, obviously you would have to meet some of the basic criteria, but what if the local jurisdiction can only really afford to have three buildings have that and not 15? So how is it the local jurisdictions just determine the criteria for selection, or?
So Chair Haas, Senator Taylor, that's a very good question, and I think it's something that we anticipate would need to be fleshed out as part of the local program rules. Certainly, the potential demand for this kind of an incentive could easily exceed the amount of a locally established program cap. I think in the city of Portland, we anticipate that we would likely focus on the most dangerous buildings that are in the greatest need. But in terms of specifics about the manner in which applications are approved to allocate a cap, we would need to figure that out at the local level.
Thank you, Chair Haas. I guess, I mean, you probably can anticipate what I'm going to say, but it seems that this is could potentially be ripe for people who are a little more sophisticated on how to get first of the line over someone else. And so, I don't know, I guess I would just like to see a little more. I don't want to have it be too controlling. I like the idea of it overall, but I guess it's a little bit concerning to me what would happen in the larger areas like Portland versus some of the smaller areas about who would be selected and not selected, because I imagine a lot of people would throw their application in more than, like you already said, there would be the ability to grant. So I don't know. That's just my, those are my two cents, but.
Senator Boquist.
I agree with both what Senator Taylor and what Senator Bertschinger pointed out is, I mean, it has the potential of sort of getting out of control. The challenge you face, though, is that chairing the Committee of Doom and Gloom for 12 years and death and destruction is it's pretty hard, because you really got to go city by city. The emergency director for Portland sitting right there, and what you might pick in Portland in terms of, and here's just a good example. I mean, you have this old building that would fall down, and you wouldn't think you'd want it to fall down. But the problem is, once the first old building falls down in the city of Portland in the earthquake, it looks like Christchurch here, and it's like the tumbling block going this way. And you are, in fact, picking winners and losers, because we're going to pick winners and losers and who's going to live or die. We're going to pick winners and losers and which helicopters we're going to launch, because we have limited fuel and limited assets. And so each, unfortunately, I hate to say this, each community is going to have to kind of, in a process like this, to determine what is the priorities, because you'll take a smaller community and they'll decide most likely that these buildings are more survivable, and those are the ones in which we're going to do rescue operations. And I just want to be even the evil Republican, in which we'll probably nationalize or whatever you want to call it, because most of these buildings are going to become public domain almost instantly in the first 30 to 60 or 90 days afterwards. And the other problem you're going to face in trying to determine which of these buildings, and that's why as much latitude has to be left to local control, is just keep in mind is that if you saw in Christchurch, it's not going to be that way here. We're going to see massive, 300 bridges gone, and these are going to be islands out there, and each city, through their emergency services and their elected officials, are going to have to pick which areas they're going to focus on as their future restoration area. It's going to be that bad. And that's the unclassified versions of it. And so while I fully agree that there probably needs to be a little bit more tightening of what are the criteria, that's going to have to be community by community. Because another good example is what is going to be acceptable in Troutdale, which will be the first place that we'll be able to carve a road out from the eastern side to, is going to be significantly different in what she's going to get to pick in downtown Portland, because it's going to be survivability to the fittest. And likewise on the Oregon coast. I mean, I will just bluntly say we probably made a mistake in picking schools in the Oregon coast in the seismic program, because we probably will not be able to rescue those individuals unless those schools that have been seismically retrofitted have the ability to survive for at least 30 days. This is a gruesome selection process. And so all the latitude we can give to the local communities, the better off we're going to be. And I'm off my soapbox and back to something not so gloomy and doomy.
Thank you, Senator Sunshine. No, I think those are excellent points. Okay, we'll keep moving forward. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Walt McMoams.
Hi, I'm Walt McMoney's. I had submitted testimony, so hopefully you got that electronically. I represent a group called Masonry Building Owners of Oregon. It's about 25 families that own a significant number of these old brickers, we call them, the URM buildings. And we're not big players, but we, typical person might own three buildings with a total of 60 or 70 units. We've been in process with the City of Portland now for almost 2 years, working on modifications to the earthquake upgrade requirements, and the basic thrust of it has come to down to mandatory upgrades. So all of us are facing these very enormous bills to upgrade our buildings. I mean, for example, life safety, which is the standard, the preferred standard by the city, would cost about $70 a square foot to do. So if you had a 40,000 square foot building, you're talking $2.8 million to upgrade. So in terms of, is there going to be lots of money being thrown at us in terms of tax savings? If this bill goes through, it's going to be a life, it's a life ring. It's not a, not showering us in lots of money, because probably with one of the building, the building that would be a 40,000 square foot building might be worth $5 or $6 million, and the taxes on that might be $100,000 a year. So if we save $100,000 a year, we're applying that for 15 years against a bill of $2.7 million. So we're not going to really come out with gobs of extra money. We're lucky to fund, let's say, 40% of the cost of these upgrades. And by the way, we're extremely happy with the way the bill has gone. Portland's been really good to work with, and staff and here has been really good to work with in terms of coming back with proposals to meet some of our concerns. So again, we're very happy this bill is moving. Hopefully it will move out of your committee and ultimately be passed. It doesn't take any money out of the state treasury. It's totally a county deal, county and city and school district deal in terms of funding this. And at least in Portland, we think that's that group of three will go for this and will adopt an ordinance that will allow significant money tax savings to go to us. I don't know, any questions in terms of how this would apply, or?
I think we've raised most of the questions that, you know, just keep molding a lump of clay here, but it feels like it's going in the right direction.
Well, great, thank you so much.
Questions?
Clay is liquefied soil. We need something better than that.
Thank you, Mr. McMoney. Douglas Schmidt.
We don't get Marion County today?
No, you give me today.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, and I'm testifying for the Assessors Association today. I want to thank the City of Portland for working with the assessors to craft the amendment. It has addressed the issues that we had on the implementation of the bill. There will still be some work that's required by the assessor's office, probably manually tracking of the costs versus the exemption amount. But at this point, the couple small concerns we have, I think we can work with the City of Portland to get them resolved. And so we are neutral on this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Marcia Kelly.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. The concept of this bill is very good. Not having any state dollars in the bill is sort of not exactly correct, because when you lose property tax dollars for education, you then make up that money with state dollars. We all need to be prepared. I would suggest that since we think that this is going to happen with great probability, and I understand that it's Goldfinger, I think, from Oregon State is one of the world's experts on earthquakes. But I would propose that instead of continually looking at property tax that then doesn't take state dollars but really does take state dollars when you're talking education, you think outside of the box and maybe sell bonds and do a revolving loan fund for retrofitting. Would keep local governments who are struggling as it is a bit less harmed, and would put the state as a whole in the position of helping people retrofit, but at the same time recouping that money.
Questions? Thank you, Marsha. And noted point on the property tax dollars having to be made up by the state. Wendy Johnson and Gil Riddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be brief. This bill fits an AOC goal of facilitating communities to prepare for catastrophic events. It provides the option for the county governing body to act, and there's a very high level of agreement among the local taxing districts, with 75% of the combined tax rate being required. The Dash 1 amendments strengthen the reasonable limits in the ordinance or resolution, so we have full support of this. Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League also supports the bill, mainly because it's a local option. Again, it's cities and counties get to just choose if they can handle this program, they can administer it. Honestly, some of our cities and counties couldn't. It's pretty complicated. You have to have the engineers and folks to monitor all this. And some cities and counties can't lose any more revenue at this point. But for those cities and counties that have the ability to do this and think long term, we think it's crucial because there just isn't a program to help pay for the seismic retrofit. As you know, the legislature has done the program for schools and for emergency facilities, but what about all the rest of the buildings? There will be little left. So this is one way to help pay for it. It's an expensive process, obviously, to do this retrofit. And so we see this as an opportunity for those cities and counties who can start this program to at least start the backlog that we have. And there are the right sideboards in place. The amount of the property tax exemption that you can get is only the cost for the retrofit. So it has that sideboard. It has the clawback if the retrofit isn't done. It does require the 75% agreement of the other taxing districts. And it's limited to a small group of properties. It's only commercial, industrial, and multifamily. And the multifamily especially is important to make sure the life and safety issue is addressed. We need to work as a state to have more incentives like this. But when local governments and state governments are both strapped, this is one way to start at it. It's not the silver bullet. Can't be used in a lot of communities, but we support the bill, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you both. Jody Weiser.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. I've been to Christ Church. That building that totally collapsed was designed by someone who didn't actually have an engineering degree. He just pretended it, he did. But there are a astounding number of buildings that were left uninhabitable. That said, we have an astounding number of children who are in very large classes with a short school year. And we have to look at those two things. The amendments to the bill are strong, but a building that has been retrofitted is quite a bit more valuable than a building that hasn't been. A good number of buildings have been retrofitted. We didn't do anything to help those landowners, property owners. And so to allow the possibility that this would 100% pay for upgrading a building to a higher standard and to a higher value doesn't make much sense. And neither does asking children to pay for the price, which is basically what we're doing. Even though school districts get to vote under the 75% rule, because of our school funding formula, they don't disagree with what the rest of the city and county people want to do. They go ahead and agree. And so if you would amend the bill and take school funding out of it, then it would make sense. The local communities would be making decisions about their own money, but not about education dollars.
All right, that rounds out our witness list for Senate Bill 311. I'll close the public hearing. I suspect we'll see some of the same faces for a public hearing on Senate Bill 118. Dave, if you could give us a briefing on this property tax bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill is about protecting school property tax dollars. So this bill excludes school property taxes from exemption or special assessment when such exemptions and special assessments require adoption by local government. It applies to exemptions and special assessment for properties initially qualified on or after the effective date of this measure. It goes a little beyond that going forward. If the property tax exemptions and special assessments are extended or increased in percentage terms or expanded to a larger class of properties, then those qualified properties would have to pay school property taxes. Now, with Dash 1 amendment, it focuses on enterprise zone and SIPs and also brownfields, the same intent, except this exclusion also applies to education service district. Original bill has only school district property taxes. Now, with Dash 1 amendment, we have ESD's property taxes too. And we have Senator Riley.
Very own Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Chuck Riley, Senate District 15. This bill is a bill to make sure that the tax exemptions, the property tax exemptions that we give to the cities and counties don't affect the schools, that schools are exempt from these. And you've heard reasons on other bills that this is a case. About 40% typically of any tax exemption comes from the school fund, and we backfill with state dollars. So this bill would simply say when we give a tax exemption, it doesn't apply to schools. Answer any questions.
Yeah. All right, well, come on back up here and we'll go through this. And, let's see. Why don't I bring up Lori Wimmer. Thank you, Senator.
Chair Haas. May I just ask a clarifying question? Maybe I missed something. So does this, what if somebody's, you know, an entity is a nonprofit or something like that? How does that, I mean, it just seems, I just didn't understand.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Taylor, the original bill touches on the low-income rental and such. But with the Dash 1 amendment, it only focuses on enterprise zone and SIPs and brownfield. So if Senator Riley's intention is to keep Dash 1 amendment, then low income rental is not included. Mm-hmm. Meaning. The exemption still continues.
Follow up. So didn't the city of Portland already work this out with Portland Public Schools? Do you know? I thought in Portland Public Schools they already said that enterprise zones had to be, they still had to pay the tax. Is that not the case? I thought the city of Portland and Portland Public Schools already. Okay, well, that's a different question for another time. Never mind.
Here's a letter from the city.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 44,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, here in support of Senate Bill 118. I have not yet read the Dash 1 amendments, but it sounds as though ESDs are now included, and that would be a good thing from our perspective. The 3 points I want to make, you have my written testimony in your system, are these. One, in addition to the loss of the revenues that school districts experience, there are two other points I'd like to make. One is that we have a situation, and it's been a perpetual situation except in certain cases, of one local government with taxing authority imposing a loss on another that doesn't, in most cases, have a say. That to me seems like a poor way to do public policy, whatever you may think of any individual tax expenditure. Secondarily, the local school district that would lose that revenue isn't the only loser because of the way the state school fund works in the equalization formula, as you've heard with respect to the other bill. That loss is spread across the state to other school districts that have no say in the matter either, even if you do provide for a local district to have an agreement, such as in the Enterprise Zone agreement that was referred to a minute ago. Everyone pays that price because of the way the hydraulics work to offset the loss of local property tax with state revenues. So finally, my last point on that is that, as Dr. Warner just reminded me, for every dollar of property tax that's lost at the local level, the state has a dog in the fight because it's a 35-cent loss to the general fund because, again, of the state school fund. And so with those 3 points, we just want to thank the maker of the bill and say if there's a way to get this through the process, we think it would be helpful as one piece of the puzzle of how to grapple with our structural funding deficit. With that, I'd take any questions.
Senator Taylor.
Now, I just wanted to understand the magnitude of this. Can you give us some examples of where this is happening when you were making your different points? So which jurisdictions are just trying to understand how much money is not being collected?
Mr. Chair and Senator Taylor, every property tax break that is issued, with the exception of urban renewal, as far as I know, and I think you mentioned an enterprise zone deal that I don't know if that's accurate.
Okay.
With exception of urban renewal, every property tax break that's issued is done by a city or county without the school districts of the state or the state itself weighing in on that decision.
Right. I was just trying to understand the magnitude of the dollars.
35 cents for
the cumulative total. Yeah. I didn't know what kind of analysis had been done on the bill.
So. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Vogel and Marcia Kelly.
Busy day. Chair House, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Here in favor of Senate Bill 118, excluding the educational entities out of the property tax is a marvelous idea because it also means that those companies who are in enterprise zones or who are taking advantage of the strategic investment program are helping to pay for the education for those people that they say that they want to have an educated workforce. This is a good start. Again, structurally, we need to address our property tax system, but at least this will stop some of the bleeding.
Thank you. Ma'am?
Good morning, Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Christine Vogel. I'm the Education Policy Chair for the League of Women Voters. The League believes that a stable state system of financing public schools is crucial for long-range planning. We believe that this bill will help with that stable school funding. When one local community chooses to abate school taxes, the state's general fund, by current law, must make up the difference since each similar student gets the same amount spent on their education across the state. League of Women Voters believes it's time to remove the ability to abate K-12 dollars from one local jurisdiction at the cost of another and at the cost of our students. We recognize from testimony that the assessors will have additional work if this is to be in place. However, League would contend that the state should not have to subsidize these communities who offer tax abatements for their school district by shorting funding for those areas that do not. Thank you.
Thank you for question, Joe. No, thank you, ladies. Gil Riddell, Wendy Johnson, and Douglas Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I guess this raises the fundamental question of, is the education community part of the larger community? The immediate investments that are made in these economic development programs are in exchange for a growth in the economy, which translates into new revenue for schools and general government. The benefits of economic development programs flow to the whole community, its economy, and to the benefit of the education community. If you look at these particular programs from the reports, you'll see that the commercial buildings under construction, expenditure achieves its purpose. Construction and process and enterprise zone has already achieved its purpose. Enterprise zone businesses, tax expenditure achieves its purpose. Long-term rural economic enterprise zone, these are very special projects for which the probability is quite good that property would not otherwise exist for taxation. Strategic investment program, anecdotal evidence suggests that the property was crucial for Oregon locations being chosen as a site of exceptionally large investments in new property and for keeping key businesses in the state. This is a situation where you have a short-term freeze on existing revenues in exchange for a return that is well worth the investment. We expect that the whole community, whether they're in education or in general government or just ordinary people, would be contributing to this and will be part of the larger group that benefits. Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, testifying on behalf of the Assessors Association, and currently the association has chosen to oppose this bill. The additional complexity and requirements put on the counties being able to collect taxes off of an exempt property or portion of an exempt property. It's basically going to require us to create what's called new tax code, a new tax code area. A tax code area is all of the taxing districts that make up your tax bill. When you look on your tax bill, there could be 10, 15 taxing districts in there. This new tax code area could have one property in it, and one taxing district, a school. So we would have to create track it for 3 years because it's now limited to enterprise zone, and then convert that back into the normal tax code area. The part about taxing exempt properties, tax assessors collect, are with the limited staff, we don't put as much effort and work into an entity that doesn't generate tax revenue. So the values that we may have on some of these properties, we would have to look at them and review them to make sure it was a fair, real market value. We would also have to create a maximum assessed value for that property, because sometimes assessors, because it's not taxable, don't have a maximum assessed value on the property. And it's especially true of specially assessed land. There's no real need to keep a maximum assessed value. The If a property comes out of exemption, we're required to run it through the statutory process of creating new value into the county, and that's identified as under 308-146-3E. It's not clear in the bill if the school districts are going to be able to collect tax for any bonds or local options they have, or if it's just the permanent rate portion. The does the bill include community college? It just says school districts or community colleges included in there because they have their own districts. The probably the a bigger part too is section 10 in the amendments, which keeps in the fact that any new exemption, any change in an exemption, even changing the extending the sunset date out, will bring that exemption into this. Right now it's just for enterprise zone property, but that will bring basically any exemption in, including charitable properties, nonprofits, that type of thing, if any of those wording or statutes are changed. The so I guess my final comment is it seems like this is a lot of extra work for assessors when there's not going to be any additional revenue generated to the specific district. They may get more property tax revenue, but that just means they'll get less state funding revenue. So I understand it's an income tax issue, but from an assessor's point of view, there's no additional revenue that will be given to those districts. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League also opposes 118 as well as the Dash 1 amendments. I don't have to say it, but you all know that we really do support property tax reform. Exemptions are definitely a part of it, but oddly, the exemptions in this bill, in the underlying bill, have to do with removing the exemption, at least as it applies to schools, to some very recent exemptions that, as a policy matter, this body all agreed to pass. The brownfield exemptions, the housing exemptions and things, we have a housing crisis in the state. The last thing we want to do is take money away from that program. And then the other, in the Dash 1 amendments, they would undo some of the recent deals on gain share and enterprise zones that are keeping the economy going. So the specific exemptions that this bill would take schools out of, we just, as a policy matter, can't support. We do think looking at exemptions is important, and I would point to House Bill 2859, which is in the House, which would say, hey, we need to look at all exemptions going forward to make sure they all have sunsets and make sure the policy decision is made on whether schools should be included, how much of an agreement we need with the other taxing districts, when the sunset should be, because some of these exemptions have been on the books for a long time without review. So we would support that, but the bill and the amendments we can't support. I'm particularly concerned about Section 8 of the bill, and then I believe it's Section 10 of the amendments, and what exactly that means, which exemptions would be at play, because it seems to take them all out. And so just from a practical matter, I don't know what the revenue impact would be or what the policy impact would be, but it needs to be clear, and for those reasons, we oppose the bill.
Question, Senator Riley?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser.
For the record, Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. It's clear the bill would need some work if it were going to go forward, but the concept really needs to be discussed because the exemptions that we have that this bill, that the amendment identifies, costing us, I believe, $245 million this year. We can't just suddenly change the rules on businesses that are in an enterprise zone. We would have to have a graceful way to make changes over time. But had this law been in place when we started enterprise zones in the 90s, we wouldn't have $245 million more. If it included urban renewal districts, that would be another $77 million that would be going to K-12 funding. That's enough for quite a few days of school, and it's really something that we need to look at as a issue. We wouldn't be the only state doing this. A number of states have exemptions that don't exempt the education dollars from funding. Maryland, Florida, Texas, and even Alabama are examples of states that when they give a property tax exemption for economic development, it does not include education dollars. Florida, for example, says that with voter approval, cities can abate or divert their own property taxes, and counties can't abate or divert their own property taxes. In Alabama, all of the state and local portion of property tax not earmarked for education on the real and personal property incorporated into a qualifying capitalized reinvestment project can be abated. Starting in 1985, we started doing enterprise zones, and the original goal was to encourage non-retail businesses to locate in depressed areas. But now, huge swaths of the state are in enterprise zones, and they extend from 3 to 15 years. And now there was testimony that on a bill this session that's asking that when an enterprise zone ends after 15 years, it should be started up as an enterprise zone or continued as an enterprise zone. So these are like never taxed areas, and the cost of education, really, we have to go back and look at that, because K-12 funding is about 41% of the tax property tax dollars, and the local communities are making decisions. It's become a practice in the last few years to say, well, we'll pass something like the seismic upgrade bill or the industrial property located any place in the county bill, or the veterans are, no, it was, I think, firefighters and police officers killed in action. We'll make these optional, and the local districts can decide if they want to use those provisions. And when we do that, we're giving up education dollars without a voice. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118, and I made an error earlier this morning. I apologize, and I left one of our key witnesses off the list. So we're going to reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 311. Thomas, I apologize for that, and we're going to get back into our seismic upgrade mindset.
Thank you, Chair Haas, and members of the committee. My name is Thomas Dyke, for the record. I'm a professor of chemistry emeritus from the University of Oregon, and a Portland resident and a member of the City Club of Portland. Early in March, the City Club membership, by a 98% favorable margin, recommended that the legislature should allow cities and counties to grant property tax exemptions to offset seismic retrofitting costs, end quote. And Senate Bill 311 is exactly the kind of measure that we had in mind with that recommendation. I served on a research committee of the City Club which studied the issue of resilience in Portland with respect to the predicted great mega thrust Cascadia subduction zone earthquakes, and to make recommendations that were feasible to improve the state of resilience so that the city of Portland and the metro area could not only just survive the earthquake, but would also continue to have its life and economy thrive. Over a 9-month period, we interviewed over 80 witnesses. We read many, many scholarly articles, popular articles concerning earthquake resilience, and we issued a report, this weighty tome, which made 14 recommendations in areas of critical energy infrastructure, building safety, transportation, social resilience, and governmental organization for resilience planning. One of those recommendations was the recommendation concerning incentives to offset the cost of seismic retrofitting for buildings which are in danger of collapse in a great Cascadia earthquake. You heard testimony earlier about dangerous buildings like unreinforced masonry buildings, non-ductile concrete buildings, soft story buildings. These are buildings which pose a grave danger to life in the face of a great earthquake by virtue of collapse or extreme damage. I want to mention that in the city of Portland alone, there are over 1,800 unreinforced masonry buildings, which include 45 schools, 35 churches, and more importantly, 270 multifamily structures with at least 6,000 residential units within them. And roughly a third of those are in the category of affordable housing for low-income people, low-income residents. And I suppose if one looks at the relative populations, you can guess that in the state of Oregon, there might be a factor of five more such buildings distributed throughout the state. So these buildings, which are in danger of collapse and provide or pose a severe risk to life, are distributed throughout the state. We feel that it is incumbent to retrofit these buildings to protect life. We feel that that is the overriding issue. On the other hand, the city of Portland and the state of Oregon face a housing crisis, particularly in the area of affordable housing. We're worried that the cost of the retrofitting may not pencil out for all building owners, and we felt that it was crucial that there be incentives, public incentives, to assist them so that this retrofitting be done to ensure the life safety of Oregonians. And we thought that was particularly true for cities and municipalities that are considering mandatory retrofit policies, that there need to be some incentives to assist the building owners so that those retrofits will pencil out and that the building stock be maintained. So for these reasons, the City Club of Portland supports Senate Bill 311, which we think provides those kinds of incentives. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Duck. Any questions? Thank you for coming down. And again, I apologize for screw up.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's close the hearing on Senate Bill 311. Before we leave committee, we have a couple of quick votes here. I hope they'll be quick. Purposes of Paul, did you say that the Senate Bill 1, the President's office wanted to go to the Ways and Means? Okay. This was the bill that Senator Courtney and Senator Thompson are sponsoring, and for purposes of movement, we'll send it to Ways and Means Committee instead of joint tax.
Other than he's the president, there's no other reason.
I think I yes. Go ahead.
You need to open a work session.
Work session on Senate Bill 1.
Mr. President, I send SB 1 to the Joint Ways and Means Committee without recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves SB 1 to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Discussion? Seeing none. So ordered. Senate Bill 1 moves to the Joint Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. And I think we're just going to leave it at that for today and come back. Yes, I'll carry over 174, 162. We have some paperwork that's needed. And back tomorrow at 8:30. Federal taxes. You're adjourned.
Work on 174.
You're adjourned.
Work on 174.